This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome, everyone. I am Kit Poliano, Dean of Biological Sciences at UC San Diego. I'd like to thank all of you for joining us today for our special event in celebration of Earth Day. The Division of Biological Sciences is celebrating its 60th anniversary this year, so I'm very excited that you've joined us for today's event in our Deep Look into the Future of Biology series. In recognition of Earth Day, today we will focus on climate change and the conservation of the planet's natural resources, which are some of the most critical challenges facing our global society. The quality of life of future generations will be determined by the choices we make today. Joining us are four fabulous scientists who will discuss the value of natural reserves as living laboratories and classrooms without walls, the impacts of rising CO2 levels, temperatures, and drought on plants, how renewable materials are paving a path to a more sustainable future, and the benefits of immersing yourself in nature to form an Earth connection. Our first speaker is Heather Henter, who is Executive Director and Academic Coordinator for the UC San Diego Natural Reserve System. The UC Natural Reserve System is a network of 40 largely undisturbed properties across the state that comprise the largest university-run reserve system in the world, covering more than 750,000 acres. The mission of the Natural Reserve System is to provide a lasting resource of untouched natural sites for research and teaching purposes to help us better understand and manage the Earth and its natural systems. Heather's work at the Natural Reserves focuses on coordinating undergraduate education in a real-world environment. Please join me in welcoming Heather.
Well, happy Earth Day, everyone. I am Heather Henter, Executive Director of the UC San Diego Natural Reserve System. I'm going to talk to you today about an entire habitat that's facing extinction, and that is coastal wetlands. I'm going to tell you why I care and why I hope you'll care. I'm going to tell you a little about what we're going to do about it, what we're trying to do about it. So the Natural Reserve System is a network of 41 ecological reserves all over the state of California that are managed by the University of California. These are undeveloped wild lands that are essentially outdoor laboratories for researchers. They're classrooms without walls for students. And these reserves represent most of the major habitats in California. They're really a window into the history of California. So I'm going to tell you about one of our reserves, a wetland reserve, one of our most vulnerable reserves, and that is the Kendall Frost Marsh. So what is a wetland? Well, it's just an area that's covered with water part of the time. That could be part of the day, could be part of the year. In the case of a coastal wetland or a salt marsh, those two terms mean the same thing. They're covered with salt water, with the ocean water, and they're covered twice a day because of the tides. So the Kendall Frost Marsh is in the northeast corner of Mission Bay, the brown bit shown in this map. The first Europeans that explored the area called Mission Bay Bahia Falsa, or False Bay. Probably because it was really too shallow to be a good port for large boats. So these photographs show Mission Bay over the last century. In this 1930s photo, you see there's a lot of fuzzy bits. All those fuzzy bits are wetlands. And in 1930, there were 4,000 acres of wetlands in Mission Bay. After World War II, the city of San Diego started to dredge Mission Bay to create an aquatic park that was deep enough for recreational boats. And this 2014 picture is essentially what Mission Bay looks like now. And you can see the fuzzy bits are only in the northeast corner. And this is Kendall Frost Marsh and adjacent city property. So what had been 4,000 acres of wetlands in 1930 has now been reduced to 40 acres, 1% of the original wetlands. So salt marshes are really extraordinary habitats. There's lots of reasons why. I'm going to give you just a couple of reasons why I think they're so extraordinary. First of all, they have organisms that are really weird and that can do things that other organisms in different habitats, other habitats can't really do. So one of these is this plant, perennial pickleweed. So salt marshes, as you can imagine, given they're covered with salt water, are really salty habitats. And that's really rough for plants. And different species deal with this salt in different ways. Pickleweed is a salt accumulator. So what it does is it takes in the seawater and it concentrates it into a really salty brine. It stores this brine in vacuoles in the terminal ends of its segments. And then when those get filled with salt, they just turn red and die and fall off. Pickleweed was eaten by the Kumeyaay. It's also sort of a hipster dish in Europe right now. I had the experience 1 year before COVID. I was doing a lot of work in Kendall Frost, and I was, you know, traipsing around the mud and the pickleweed. And then I went on vacation, and I sat down at a fancy restaurant in Ireland with my husband, and I was served pickleweed. I was a little taken aback by this, but it was actually pretty good and salty. So we also have an invasion of the body snatchers thing going on at Kendall Frost Marsh. So these snails in the top photograph are California horned snails. They're very common in Kendall Frost Marsh. They're parasitized by a trematode. And like the aliens in the invasion of the body snatchers, these parasites don't kill their host. In this case, they castrate them. They just eat the reproductive bits and they leave everything else. So the snails continue to live and continue to be good hosts for the parasite, but they don't reproduce. These parasites also have weird, complex life histories. So they start in a snail host, and then they have to infect a specific species of fish host, and then a specific species of bird host before the parasites themselves can reproduce. Salt marshes also have a real superpower, and that is that they're huge carbon sequesters. So carbon sequestration is simply the capture and storing of carbon. And this is super important in our fight against climate change. Salt marshes actually sequester more carbon than a mature forest of the same size, the same area. How do they do this? Well, they're really productive. So plants grow a lot in salt marshes. And through photosynthesis, they take in a lot of carbon dioxide. So they're storing a lot of carbon. But then they die. And when they die, they get buried in the wet mud. And water holds a lot less oxygen than air, so the microbes that cause decomposition work very slowly in this wet mud, and so decomposition is very slow. So you can see one of the ways we study this is by looking at soil cores shown in these pictures. And in this picture of a soil core that's from Kendall Frost Marsh taken a few months ago, you can see the top 15 or 20 centimeters is really packed with dead plants. So this is undecomposed organic matter, carbon that's being stored in the mud rather than in our atmosphere causing climate change. So one of the most sobering facts about salt marshes is that they're facing extinction due to sea level rise. People predict that salt marshes as an entire habitat will be completely gone from California and Oregon by the year 2100. And of course, with them will go all of the organisms that depend on salt marshes, like these already endangered Ridgway's rails. So why are salt marshes so vulnerable to sea level rise? Well, this is an aerial photo of Kendall Frost Marsh. And you can see down here is Pacific Beach Drive, and this is Crown Point Drive. Kendall Frost is surrounded by development. So as the seas rise, Kendall Frost Marsh will have nowhere to go. Another threat that's facing Kendall Frost Marsh is that we think it's sinking. We don't have great data on this. We'd like to get better data. But this is Rose Creek. Rose Creek historically and currently was the major source of sediment and fresh water into the bay. But it's now separated from Kendall Frost Marsh by development. This happens to be an RV park called Campland. So this sediment is not going into the marsh. The good news, however, is that the city of San Diego is, as we speak, redesigning this whole northeast corner of Mission Bay. And we hope that in the final plans, they will reconnect Kendall Frost with Rose Creek, and it will again have a source of sediment. So what are we doing to help save wetlands? Well, we are using Kendall Frost Marsh for research, education, and outreach to both better understand how wetlands work and how best to manage wetlands in the face of sea level rise, and to engage the public to better steward and save this important resource and others like it. So I've already talked about research on carbon sequestration. There are also lots of opportunities for education at Kendall Frost Marsh, both university education and K-12 education. We do as much outreach as we can. These are climate strikers in 2019 that marched to the marsh, to Kendall Frost Marsh, to demand governmental action to address climate change. These are City College students volunteering at Kendall Frost Marsh, doing bird education. These are elected officials speaking at Love Your Wetlands Day, our largest outreach event of the year. It happens every February. This is Mayor Todd Gloria, Councilperson Jen Campbell, and Secretary of State Dr. Shirley Weber. So what I'm really most excited about right now is that we have just finished fundraising to build this new building, the Kendall Frost Field Station and Learning Center. And this building will really facilitate our ability to do the research, education, and outreach that I've just mentioned. There are a lot of cool things about this building. I'll just talk about one, and that is in the southeast corner of the building will be a large multi-purpose room. It'll have a big deck and big windows with a good, great view of the marsh, and it will be a very flexible space. It could be a workroom for researchers. It could be a classroom for students. It could be a gathering space for a public event. So we're excited about this building, and we're most excited about the programming that this building will allow.
Thank you for your inspiring presentation, Heather. I am pleased to introduce our next speaker, Dr. Julian Schroeder. Julian is the Novartis Chair and Distinguished Professor in Cell and Developmental Biology. He is a pioneering scientist who has identified and characterized ion channels that play a critical role in mediating resistance to drought and stress. His recent research is focused on uncovering the fundamental mechanisms by which plants respond to and protect themselves from climate change-linked stresses. Julian has won many prominent awards and is a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and a member of both the U.S. National Academy of Sciences and the German National Academy of Sciences, Leopoldina. Please join me in welcoming Julian.
Thank you all for joining us and happy Earth Day. My name is Julian Schroeder. I'm a professor in the Division of Biological Sciences at UC San Diego. And I will be speaking about how plants are going to cope with climate change and why do we care? The major reason for climate change is the increase in greenhouse gases, as you see here. And the major greenhouse gas is carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that has been rising steeply in recent years and continues to rise. We are now at a CO2 concentration in the atmosphere that's 50% higher than pre-industrial revolution and higher than any time during human evolution. Now, today we're talking about plants, and plants love carbon dioxide. They use it as a fertilizer, you could say. And in fact, if we look at this redwood tree, the majority of the mass of this tree is carbon fixed from carbon dioxide from the atmospheres through photosynthesis. So if there's more CO2 in the atmosphere, should we expect that plants actually grow better because they have more CO2? And this study here looked at this through satellite imaging on a global scale. And what you could see is until the year 2000, we actually had an increase in greening of the planet, but that stopped in the year 2000. And as no longer the case. Why is that no longer the case? It's because we are now at a level of carbon dioxide already in the atmosphere shown here that is at a point where global temperatures are increasing. And if we stay on this trajectory without doing anything about it, by the end of the century, we'll have 8.5 degrees Celsius warmer temperatures average around the globe. And if you think 8.5 is not a lot, please remember that's 15 degrees Fahrenheit hotter. That's a very hot planet. Now, there are other scenarios where we're trying to sequester more carbon. Now, today we want to talk about plants and how are they going to deal with this. And the major issues here are heat stress and heat resistance, drought stress and drought resistance, water use efficiency. I'll be saying a few things about that. And then also something you may not have heard about as much, salinity stress. So, for example, in California, in the Central Valley or Imperial County, when we grow crops, we irrigate them. And when you irrigate crops over time, you build up salt in the fields, as you can see in the image at the bottom right. Now, in California alone, salinity stress in agriculture causes losses of over $4 billion a year. And globally, that's a lot more. Let me tell you something briefly about our research on salinity stress before going on to drought and water use efficiency. Several years ago, we identified a mechanism using the lab plant Arabidopsis thaliana to look at this. So when you irrigate soils, you overaccumulate sodium in the soil. And when nutrients and water move up to the leaves, sodium is toxic to leaves. So we discovered a kind of sodium filter that removes the sodium from these nutrients and protects the leaves. Now, if this gene is mutated and no longer functional, you'll see these plants are very salt sensitive. Okay, that was very interesting. But it turns out that in wheat and rice, major quantitative trait loci that protect certain varieties of wheat and rice from salt use this exact mechanism that we discovered in Arabidopsis. So now with the knowledge of the gene and the molecular mechanisms, breeders are using molecular marker-assisted breeding in wheat and rice to improve commercial varieties, and scientists are looking at other plant species to determine if a similar sodium filter can be used in those species. Now, let's move on to the question of drought and heat. And this is just a quote from a recent study. Agriculture is predicted to be the most negatively impacted industry resulting from rising temperatures, drought, and the accompanying challenges. And we can also look at this on a global scale. We see here modeled agricultural losses for these major crops, corn, rice, wheat, and soy. And in the United States, we see an average countrywide loss of about 15%. And in countries close to the equator, those losses are even greater. So one question is, how much water do plants use? Well, agriculture uses about 70% of fresh water, human fresh water use on the planet. And in dry regions like California, that can be 80%, and more dry regions, even 90% of fresh water use. So why do plants need so much water? That's shown right here. So plants, as we already know, they breathe in carbon dioxide. And when they breathe in carbon dioxide, they do this through small pores in the surface of leaves called stomata. And when CO2 enters the leaf, water also evaporates from the leaf. And a typical plant, for every carbon molecule fixed by photosynthesis, plants lose 300 water molecules. So plants do not use water very effectively. So that's kind of bad if a plant is experiencing drought. Now, plants, in response to drought, synthesize a hormone called abscisic acid. And abscisic acid protects plants from drought. And one of the things that abscisic acid does that's very important is it's under drought, it causes closing of these stomatal pores. Remember, these pores are how plants lose 95% of their water, 300 water molecules for every CO2 taken in. So we and other laboratories have identified major mechanisms by which this drought stress hormone, abscisic acid, protects plants from drought. And we and also industry, breeders, and technology are looking at how these advances can be used to improve drought tolerance of plants. And there are quantitative advances that are being made. But today we want to focus a little bit more on the atmosphere and CO2. And interestingly, the CO2 increase that we're seeing in the atmosphere also doesn't close, but narrows the stomatal pores. You might ask, well, why would plants narrow their stomatal pores because of more CO2? Well, part of the reason is every night when it's dark, because of respiration and lack of photosynthesis, CO2 goes up in leaves, and that signals to the stomata that it's nighttime and you can close your stomatal pores. But almost nothing was known about how this works, and we wanted to discover what the mechanisms and pathway are. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about experiments here. So how do we discover mechanisms? Well, we do genetics. And this is an example of the technology we use. So here we have highly sensitive thermal imaging camera, and we're imaging an Arabidopsis plant. And if we expose it to low CO2, like 100 parts per million CO2, the leaves are cooler than if we expose it to high CO2. Why are they cooler? Because at low CO2, the stomata open. And when the stomata open, plants transpire more water. And when they transpire more water, the leaves get cooler. Just like when we perspire or sweat, we do that to cool our bodies. So now in a genetic screen, we can expose, say, 200 plants to low CO2 and ask, is any of them, not one of them, not cooling down? And this is an example of such a mutant called high temperature one, where no matter what the CO2 concentration is, it's at a higher temperature. And then using this approach, we map and identify the gene and the mechanism. And by today, we've identified a whole pathway by which CO2 closes or narrows stomatal pores. And in the laboratory, we actually use this to then increase the sensitivity of the stomata to CO2. And we could increase the water use efficiency by 40% in those plants in the lab. What does that mean, 40%? It means that for every CO2 the plant was taking in, rather than losing 300 water molecules, it was losing about 180 water molecules. Now, that's interesting for agriculture, but it's also interesting for trees. If you think of recent forest fires and wildfires, we would like to have trees that fix carbon, that do their beautiful carbon capture, but don't dry out soils and are more water use efficient. So this kind of research on the long run could play an important role in that area as well. So just getting back to what I said earlier, these plants now can take in carbon dioxide, but lose less water in exchange by affecting how these stomata respond to CO2 themselves. Now, going back, obviously there's a lot of research to be done, and there's a lot of work being done also by breeders, given the advances in molecular marker-assisted breeding. And through the genomic revolution, breeders have completely new tools at their hands, and they can often use the genes and mechanisms we identify to then work in breeding as well as in genetic engineering. So understanding how plants can increase heat resistance is going to be incredibly important for the planet. Drought resistance, I explained to you water use efficiency and how that can be done. And of course, salinity resistance. And I'd like to just end by showing you our team here pre-pandemic. And these are the people who are doing the hard work in the laboratory to advance our understanding of how plants respond to climate-linked stresses. And here are the names of the members of my laboratory. And many of them now have their own labs, as shown in parentheses, and also our collaborators. So thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you, Julian, for your exciting presentation. For our next speaker, I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Michael Burkhart, Professor of Chemistry and Biochemistry in the Division of Physical Sciences here at UC San Diego. The Burkhart Lab pursues interdisciplinary research in the fields of organic and biological chemistry with a focus on studying the mega enzymes that synthesize fatty acids, pigments such as melanin, and antibiotics. As director of the Center for Renewable Materials, his team has focused on the development of biodegradable materials from algae and other renewable sources, and their applications to consumer products in order to reduce the plastic waste that is especially troubling in marine environments. Please join me in welcoming Professor Mike Burkhart.
Hi, I'm Mike Burkhart. I'm a professor of chemistry and biochemistry here at UC San Diego, and I am associate director of the Center for Algae Biotechnology and the director of the Center for Renewable Materials. And I'm here to talk to you today about renewable and biodegradable plastics from algae. So we have a problem on our planet, and that is that it's covered in plastic trash. We're used to using plastic for all kinds of useful applications. The problem, however, is that plastic was so well made and designed that it lives forever and it never degrades and really only falls apart into microplastics, which have become a big problem in our world's oceans. So there are 17 trillion pounds of plastic on the planet, and this amount is growing, and something needs to be done about it. So the fact of the matter is that recycling plastic really is a myth, and that is that there's only a few types of plastic that can be recycled, as are shown in this slide. And it turns out that the ones that are recycled are pretty much limited to PET and polypropylene. As it turns out, however, less than 25% of these plastics are ever recycled, not to mention the fact that to make a new material, you cannot use more than 20% of recycled material in it. That means 80% must be virgin plastic. So we have a big problem, and something needs to be done about this. Now, how do we change our behavior on the planet? So you can imagine a few scenarios. One would be to stop using all products with plastic. And whereas that might be realizable, think about all the things that actually require plastic, like packaged foods or ballpoint pens, things that you use every day. If you didn't have plastic, what would replace it? There's a lot of discussion about making companies that produce plastic to actually recover their products. And that, of course, is going to be a very challenging thing to do, but definitely something that should be thought about. And finally, we can be thinking about developing new types of plastics, plastics that are biodegradable and that can come from renewable sources, such that when they do biodegrade, we're not entering fossilized carbon into the atmosphere. And this last area that we think that we have an opportunity to make some really big achievements in. I'll remind you that most plastic comes from petroleum, and that is the petrochemicals that come from oil that is pulled out of the ground. And of course, 1.2 trillion gallons of petroleum are consumed every year. Only part of that is going into plastics. It turns out petroleum really is ancient algae. This is algae that millennia ago fell to the bottom of the ocean and were converted in heat and pressure into the petroleum that we mine out of the ground all the time. However, we believe that it's going to be possible to actually grow algae in real time to take up the CO2 that's in the atmosphere and convert that into biomolecules like fatty acids, isoprenoids, and carbohydrates, and that we can use our skills as chemists and biologists to take those materials and turn them into new polymer replacements. And we think that we can use our science to achieve better materials. So just a little bit about algae. These are photosynthetic aquatic organisms. There are different types of algae. You might be familiar with macroalgae, which is seaweed that's growing off the coast here in San Diego. But there's also microalgae. These are single-cellular microorganisms that can be grown in all different types of environments. And what that's really where we focus in CalCab, and that is we're working with single-cellular organisms that are scalable, highly productive. It turns out that they're much more productive than even vascular plants and conventional types of agriculture. They're very sustainable. You don't need arable land. You don't even need fresh water in order to grow these. You can grow them in saline, brackish, or even wastewater. And we have the ability to edit the genomes of these organisms using the tools that we have of molecular biology. So there are a lot of real benefits in looking at algae as a potential source of biomanufacturing. And biomanufacturing is simply using living organisms to produce molecules that are important to us. Of course, agriculture we're already doing to make the food that we eat, but also algae is a type of agriculture and a good opportunity to use for biomanufacturing. So just a little bit about the California Center for Algae Biotechnology. This was founded back in 2008 as the San Diego Center for Algae Biotechnology. We quickly started gaining new faculty, not only here on campus, but also throughout the California area. And we became CalCab in 2013. And then we started pivoting away from petroleum into renewable materials, as I'll tell you in a little while. And the good news is that all along the way, the Department of Energy and the state of California have been supporting the research that we're doing. So when we started CalCab, one of the first things that we wanted to do was have a methodology to grow algae here on our campus and convert that. Originally, what our interest was to make biofuels. So we developed a cultivation strategy. Over on the left, you can see we use these hanging bags that we have in the greenhouse. We can grow up to 100 liters of algae with those. Outdoors, we have these circular, what we call mini ponds that can grow up to 800 liters. And finally, we have two of these raceway ponds that can grow up to 8,000 liters each, allowing us to get close to 20,000 liters of algae cultivation right here on our campus. And then we came up with methodologies to actually convert that algae into useful products. And our first focus, as I mentioned, was to make biofuels out of it. So here's a picture of my colleague Skip Pomeroy, who got together with a group of undergraduates, and they started making biofuels out of the algae that we were growing on campus. They had originally started with using vegetable oils from our waste vegetable oils from cafeterias, and have pivoted towards the use of algae, and were able to make a barrel here that got demonstrated as a fuel to use in a diesel motorcycle. But I should mention that algae biofuels have already been demonstrated in cars and in airplanes, and also in boats. And it turns out that it's actually quite feasible to use algae to make biofuels. And in fact, the industry was able to produce biofuels from algae for about $10 a gallon, which is really very close to where we need to be in terms of the cost. Certainly the economies of scale would bring that down to competitive ability to compete with petrochemicals. However, we had a bit of a problem in 2014, and that is the oil market took a crash. And what happened in 2014 was the Saudis increased production and there was fracking going on all over the country. And the price of oil went below $50 a barrel. And really a lot of interest in biofuels kind of dried up. And we were thinking to ourselves, this is a problem. We need to focus on molecules that we can actually change the world with and not in products that people aren't so interested in anymore. And that's when we pivoted to looking at other types of products from algae. And of course, petroleum is the cheapest commodity on the planet. The reason that our food is relatively inexpensive is because petroleum is relatively inexpensive. And it's subsidized heavily by government. However, if we can start moving towards products that have higher value, things like animal feed, materials or pharmaceuticals, we can start moving into products that have much higher cost, yet lower volume than is needed to make biofuels. And this is when we decided to start this group, the Center for Renewable Materials, where we have this fantastic collection of scientists from all over campus, as well as outside of campus, looking at making renewable materials and turning those into product prototypes. And in fact, not only do we have biologists and chemists and engineers, but we also have artists and designers who are working with us to actually make real types of product prototypes out of the materials that we develop. So we focused on polyurethanes initially, and that is because polyurethanes have a very broad application from films and coatings to rigid foams and soft foams and everything in between. And so we decided that this would be a really exciting area to look into. Polyurethanes are made from two precursors. We have diisocyanates as a part A and polyols or diols in part B. And these react together to form polyurethane polymers. And we started trying to see if we could replace these with renewable biomass. And so our first thing that we did in 2014 was take the algae oils, triisoglycerides. We converted those into epoxides using oxidation chemistry and opened those epoxides to make polyols. And condensing those with diisocyanate allowed us to make our first algae polyurethane. And this looked so exciting that we decided to collaborate with a local company called Arctic Foam that makes surfboards. And together, we went through a series of optimization of our materials to try to get materials that had performance enhanced characteristics. And at the end of the day, in 2015, we were able to make a surfboard from algae biomass. And this was really exciting. Over on the right, you can see our mayor at the time, Kevin Faulkner, with Rob Machado, who is a world-class surfer, and Steve Mayfield next to him. So this was really the kickoff of our materials project and a really successful one because it got a lot of publicity. And then the next thing we knew, we were being contacted by shoe manufacturers saying, hey, can you make flexible foams as well? And that's when we started doing that. So to keep this fairly short, we take our algae biomass and purify the fatty acids out of it. And then we isolate the unsaturated fatty acids, in this case, palmitic acid, and ozonolyze that with ozone to make a diacid azelaic acid. This azelaic acid can then be polymerized with renewable diols to make a polyol. And then we condense that with diisocyanate. And this was the first algae flexible polyurethane. And we made this a couple of years ago. And it had really nice properties. And we were able to show that we could make flexible polyurethanes from algae biomass. That's when we started moving towards the next challenge for us. And that was making isocyanates out of algae biomass. It turns out that renewable isocyanates simply do not exist. You cannot buy these. And so we actually demonstrated the first application of taking the diacids and making isocyanates out of them by using some clever flow chemistry. And here what we've done is we've used 3D printing to make these pumps that are syringe pumps out of 3D printed materials, and putting that all together using flow chemistry to make algae-based diisocyanates. This allows us now to get 100% renewable and over 50% algae content polymers. And perhaps as important to that is that these polymers are biodegradable. So it turns out that these are 100% renewable and 100% biodegradable. And in fact, we've been able to show that in compost and soil, these can completely degrade over the course of about 20 weeks. We've now started looking at those compost degradation studies, identifying the bacteria that are in them and sequencing the genes from those bacteria to identify the enzymes that are actually doing that biodegradation. And we're now working on a program where we can actually take those enzymes and use them in a recycling program, such that if someone is not going to treat their plastic product appropriately and it somehow gets into the ocean, it will slowly biodegrade. But alternatively, we can take that plastic, we can recycle it, and not just melt it and re-inject it, but actually depolymerize it down to the monomers and reuse them to make virgin polymers. And so this is what we call the bioloop. And this is an exciting new opportunity where these polymers not only are biodegradable, but are 100% recyclable. We are now working with shoe manufacturers to try to commercialize some of these products. And we're hoping for an initial launch of our flip-flops sometime next year. And I hope that I've been able to show you that we have really been able to take our skills with biology and chemistry here at UC San Diego and try to make products and solutions that will help the planet. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Mike, for sharing your impactful research with us. I am pleased to introduce our final speaker, Dr. Carolyn Curley. Carolyn is Associate Professor in Ecology, Behavior, and Evolution here at UC San Diego. Her research program uses chemical fingerprints to determine what animals eat and where they find their food to develop data-driven strategies for the conservation of endangered species and imperiled habitats. She studies habitats ranging from Baja California to the Bering Sea and species that include California condors, fur seals, sea turtles, and giant iguanas. Professor Curley recognizes that conservation actions are both a luxury that can only be accomplished when one's basic needs are met and a pressing necessity motivated when individuals feel a personal connection to the planet. Towards that end, she seeks to foster an earth connection through the unique courses that she teaches and the students she mentors at UC San Diego. Please welcome Professor Carolyn Curley.
Hi, I'm Carolyn Curley, a professor of conservation biology at UC San Diego. I'm going to focus on two things for my Earth Day talk. I'll share an example of conservation action research that we do in my lab at UC San Diego. Then I'm going to focus on how I approach my goal to create Earth connection with my students to inspire them toward conservation action. So first, let me speak to this idea of creating Earth connection. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, and my parents took my brothers and me all over, hiking and camping in the Western states and Canada. And my parents are outdoors people. So for them, passing along a love of nature was simply a part of life. My earth connection, or my positive relationship with the planet and the natural world, was given to me from birth by my parents. It was literally my birthright. So from that, I learned that nature is a place that nourishes my well-being, increases my connection, with my higher purpose fosters peaceful introspection and is something of inherent worth that should be valued, protected, and preserved. And because of this earth connection that I was given from my parents, I'm now a conservation biologist. I feed my earth connection partly by doing research with applications to saving the planet. I want to create and build the same type of earth connection in my students at UCSD so they will be inspired to also save the planet. So I mentioned that I feed my earth connection by doing research that leads to solving conservation problems. And one big conservation problem is invasive species on islands. Humans have been introducing species to islands for centuries, and rats are the most common invader. They frequently arrive with humans via ship traffic. And rats have been introduced to about 90% of the world's islands. And you can see that they're fairly ubiquitous by this on this map, with each red dot representing an island system that's been invaded by rats. Consequently, rats alone are responsible for about 40 to 60% of all bird and reptile extinctions. And the main mechanism for extinctions by rats is from direct predation, as seen here with a rat eating chicks from a New Zealand fantail bird nest. For my PhD work many years ago, I studied the impacts of invasive rats on the Aleutian Islands in Alaska, as seen in the top portion of this map. Rats have been introduced to about 17 of the islands in the chain, and I measured the effects of rats on the coastal ecosystems on these islands by comparing the community structure of the rocky intertidal on islands with rats and without rats. We built on this work to eradicate or remove rats from Rat Island in the Aleutians. And then we studied how removing the rats restored the coastal ecosystem on this one particular island. So our invasive rat in the Aleutian Islands is the Norway rat, which I'm holding in this picture. My initial research question was, can invasive rats actually change the coastal rocky intertidal community structure in the Aleutian Islands by eating certain species? So the rocky intertidal is the area surrounding an island or around an island that is exposed to the air at low tide and underwater at high tide. Here's a picture of me standing in the rocky intertidal on one of our study islands in an orange suit to protect me in case I fall in the water. I surveyed the intertidal communities on islands with and without rats, about 35 islands in total, and I estimated the numbers of marine invertebrates, which are those tiny little critters such as snails, limpets, barnacles, mussels, and others that just live on the shoreline. And I also estimated how much of the intertidal area was covered by algae. So what I found was this: rats eat the shorebirds on the islands, specifically gulls and oyster catchers. And you can see that in this drawing on this slide. My big fat rat has a big arrow down to these birds, which is what they eat. And when the birds are gone, and they're no longer there, and they're no longer eating the critters that live in the intertidal, those little invertebrates. So the populations of the invertebrates grow out of control. And that's indicated by that tiny arrow pointing down to the really big limpets and snails in this picture. Finally, then, the intertidal becomes overrun by these tiny herbivores, and they graze away a significant portion of the kelp and algae that would normally dominate this system. So islands with rats have fewer shorebirds, more intertidal invertebrates, and then less kelp cover. So by eating all the birds, these rats are indirectly shaping the community structure of the intertidal. So we were able to use those data to get permission to do a rat eradication experiment on the island, on Rat Island, which is pictured here. You can see our little field camp on the beach there. Once the rats were removed from the island, it was renamed Hawatha Island, which is the original Aleut name that means the island over there with two knolls, which refers to two of the hills that are on the island. So after we removed the rats, our group studied the island's recovery. We went back and measured the species in the intertidal, and we surveyed the birds in 2013, which was 5 years after the rat eradication. And then we did it again in 2019, which was 11 years after the rat eradication. And we found that both the gulls and the oyster catchers, which remember were the bird predators in the intertidal, they were significantly recovering, with the oyster catchers at levels approaching those that we observed on islands that had never had rats in our 2008 study, as shown by the orange diamonds in this picture. We also saw significant decreases in the intertidal herbivores that are eaten by the shorebirds. So you can see in this graph, many species of invertebrates were reduced to levels that approach or surpass those that we observed on islands that have never had rats in our 2008 study. At the top of the graph, you can see that the kelp increased, especially in 2019, which is indicated by the darker blue bar. 2013 is the lighter blue bars. So our data indicate that the marine community actually did recover about 11 years after the invasive rats were removed. And this is an ecological and conservation success. So we demonstrated a much quicker than expected recovery of a marine system after the removal of a terrestrial predator. And that's important for conservation because it shows that actually removing invasive species from islands is indeed effective at restoring damaged ecosystems. So those types of data open the door for others seeking funds and opportunities to do this type of work elsewhere. So doing this type of conservation action work actually strengthens my own personal Earth connection by allowing me to contribute in even a small way to preserving and protecting the planet. So then how do I pass that passion along to those I'm charged with teaching? As I said at the beginning of the talk, I believe I can do this by creating and fostering Earth connection in my students to create more conservation-minded stewards of the planet. Part of that for me is working with the UC San Diego Alternative Breaks Program to provide nature immersion type field courses to UC San Diego undergraduates. So we did this in Iceland in August of 2019 with two collaborators, Emily Louis of the Alternative Breaks Program and Dr. Erla Ornalsdottir, the president of Holar University in Iceland, where we stayed for part of our trip. Over half of the 15 UC San Diego undergraduates that came with us on this trip received significant financial aid from the Alternative Breaks Program, and this allowed us to include non-affluent students in our field course. So aside from the scientific goals for this course, the most important part was to spend hours in nature, hopefully building up this Earth connection. So lots of data, such as those featured in Richard Love's book, The Last Child in the Woods, indicate that we as humans are calmer, we're happier, we're healthier, and we're more at peace and in touch with our intuition when we are in nature and in wild places. But most people don't take the time to be in nature, or they don't seek it out, or they don't know the kind of calm and ease we as humans can experience by immersion in wild places, or they simply don't have the opportunity to be in nature. So as a conservation biologist, it's my mandate to help others to discover the importance of connecting to nature so they will be more inspired to take conservation action. It's easy to do that on these types of field trips that I spoke of in Iceland. But we also want to be able to do that in the classroom. And when I am in the classroom, I try to foster this as well. I do this by sharing examples to illustrate ecology, evolution, and conservation biology concepts from my own or my friends' field research. So here I am teaching in the classroom at UC San Diego. And this is a slide from one of my lectures. And you can see that I show photos of myself and my colleagues in these wild places working in these field sites. And I hope to open the door then to my students' own desire to explore and protect and learn the natural world. I'm hoping to actually inspire their Earth connection by showing them lots and lots of pictures of myself and my colleagues out in the field. So I drag my son, Jeremiah, all over hiking, and he's lucky to have a mom who helps him learn and develop his own Earth connection. It's his birthright as it was mine. And I want to create that for all of my UCSD students. So I imagine what they will be inspired to accomplish if they develop an Earth connection during their time at UC San Diego, even if it means they don't use a plastic straw, or maybe they start carrying a metal water bottle instead of using a disposable plastic one. Anything, any small thing is enough. I figure one tiny step at a time, one Earth connection at a time, we can start to create these better stewards of the planet. And then we can inspire them to be the future conservationists who will take over when my colleagues and myself are no longer doing this work. Thank you so much for listening to our talks today.
Wonderful. Thank you, Professor Curley, for your inspiring presentation. And thank you to all of our panelists today for this really fabulous celebration of Earth Day. It's truly inspiring to hear what each and every one of you are doing to help us protect the planet and move towards a more sustainable future. So I wanted to start with Professor Burkhart. Mike, what has been the biggest challenge in getting algal commercial products to the market?
You know, I mentioned that algae really pencils out when it comes to making biofuels. But certainly the biggest problem is that it's kind of a chicken and egg problem, which is that farmers could start producing algae like they do other types of crops, but they need a reason to do it. They need to be able to sell their products and have them be used. we need those materials, or those, I should say, that biomass to be produced for us then to convert it into the products that we're making. So we really need some help to kind of kickstart this industry, right? And that's really going to have to come from some type of support from the government, who can either assist farmers to grow more algae, and also at the same time assist us to get all the scenarios in place that we can start converting it. I think one of the things that a lot of people don't realize is just how much subsidy goes to petroleum and to the infrastructure for transporting, shipping, and other types of resources that are provided to petroleum and make petroleum very cheap for us. And those just don't exist for these types of competing but renewable technologies.
I have a similar question for Professor Schroeder. Julian, what will it take to get these traits into commercially viable or commercial products or plants that are agriculturally important? And are you working on that, thinking about it, or what do you envision for the future?
So that depends on the trait. Many of the traits I spoke about are actually traits that plants have within their genome. And so we have entered an era of advanced genomics where, let's say you take a corn, there are wild relatives to the commercial corn that might have traits that give you enhanced resilience to climate-linked stresses. But that wild corn obviously doesn't produce a nice corn cob with sweet corn that consumers would want to use. But through the genomics revolution, it's becoming possible to not only identify the genes, but to use molecular marker enhanced breeding. So what's happening right now is that's probably the fastest route right now to get an advance from this science into a commercial variety. For example, I mentioned salinity tolerance that's being done in both wheat and rice presently. Now, there are obviously also other technologies, but they take longer and are more costly. That includes things like GMO. But when you're talking about genes that are already in the plant genome or in the variety of plants, then these sort of advanced breeding technologies are really playing a very important role. Now, in addition to that, there are also other new approaches such as genome editing using CRISPR. And there's a lot of research in that domain that could become very interesting in terms of, again, affecting the genes that are within the plant. Yeah.
Dr. Henter, can you tell us a little bit about the importance of having a natural reserve system that spans the whole state and how people can get involved and visit these really special places?
Yeah, our reserve system, the fact that we have this interconnected system of reserves that cover all of the major habitats in the state is really valuable because we can ask questions of the whole system. We've been doing monitoring of various environmental variables across all of the reserves, which give scientists a wealth of data that they can use to ask questions about how the climate is changing, for example. I can tell you how here in San Diego, people can get involved with some of our reserves. We have different volunteer programs. Of course, a lot of the volunteer programs are kind of on hold because of COVID. So at the Kendall Frost Marsh, that's the case. We usually have the first Saturday of every month is a volunteer day. We're not doing that, but we hope that will open up again by the fall when UCSD is kind of back to normal. But we do have another volunteer opportunity at one of our other reserves, at the Scripps Coastal Reserve. We do some invasive plant management every Friday morning. So that's one way you can get involved here locally with our reserves.
Professor Curley, we've all been cooped up in our homes during this last really challenging year. Do you have a tip about how we can re-engage with nature if maybe we haven't been doing that, or tell us why it's important that we do that right now as we come out of this pandemic?
Absolutely. Before I answer that question, I have to give another plug to the reserve system. I've taught classes in the reserve system. It's a really great way for us as UC professors to bring students into field locations in a pretty easy way. The reserve system is amazing. My favorite ones have been Big Sur, and we're really, really lucky to have that. So I just have to give that a plug for a nature connection for students. But for me personally, I'm lucky that I can live close to the beach. All of us here are pretty lucky that we can live fairly close to the beach. And so in my experience, you can get a daily connection to nature very simply by walking out your door. Like almost all of us in this really nice area of the planet have some access to nature, whether it's walking around our neighborhood and looking for a park or the trees that your neighbors grow, or walking down to the beach or driving down to the beach, or however you get there. I do a bicycle ride almost most days, and I go through the Torrey Pines, up the Torrey Pines Hill. There's this beautiful Torrey Pines Reserve, which is really close to our campus that students can easily access and walk through. There's many ways that you can reconnect with nature, even if that's just sitting in your backyard or sitting on your balcony, or however you can grow a green plant, and that could take you into a green space that's connected to nature. Anything that's alive and living that you can connect with is creating and forging a connection with nature. Even if it's sitting on your front porch and watching the birds that fly by and fly up and down, or planting milkweed in your garden so that butterflies will land there. Anything, these tiny, tiny things you can do are sometimes just enough to get a little bit of a nature connection.
I'd like to wrap this up just by thanking each and every one of our panelists for their fantastic and inspiring presentations, and for their ongoing work to help protect the planet and lead us towards a more sustainable future. These efforts are truly crucial, and we truly do need to come together in new ways to work together as scientists with each other and with the public and with our elected officials and with members of the community, because we are at truly a tipping point in the future of the planet, where the choices that we make today and the individuals we elect today will determine the lives of future generations and what they experience and their ability, what the planet that they can connect with will look like. So please let us redouble our efforts to protect this beautiful planet that we live on. And thank you so much to everyone for joining us here today.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.